Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today we're joined by Nadia and Lucas from Alpiq, a Swiss utility with a long history in clean power generation and pumped hydro. The conversation explores the complementary roles of pumped hydro and battery storage, how the Swiss energy system works, Alpiq's strategy for acquiring battery projects across European markets, and the challenges they've encountered along the way. I think listeners will be interested in the key stats on bringing Alpiq's latest pumped hydro plant to market, taking 12 years to build, but having an 80 to 100 year lifespan, as well as how they're needing to adapt conventional gas-fired generation strategies in Iberia as solar takes over the generation stack. So, can Europe's current market rules actually support the massive scale of storage anticipated in the energy transition? Let's jump in. Hello both, welcome to Transmission. I'm really excited to have you here. As ever, we'd love to get started with just getting a bit of background from you both. Nadia, what is your role in Alpiq?
Yes, so I have been working in the energy and financial sector for more than 16 years. And actually, I used to work for Alpiq for more than 10 years. And I returned last year when Alpiq decided to implement the flexibility strategy and build up its BESS portfolio. So this is what I have been doing since last year, building up our BESS assets in Europe.
Okay, Lucas.
Good. Lucas Greschnecht. I've been with Alpiq for 3 years, but been in the energy space since the beginning of the century. First for Nuon, which is now part of the Vattenfall Group. Then a few years for Macquarie Infrastructure Fund here in London. 10 years for Statkraft. 5 of those years in Brazil. And now for 3 years responsible at Alpiq for the international activities, which from a Swiss company means activities outside Switzerland.
Okay, great. And I hope that gives our listeners two bits of information. One, we have two guests on. And the second part, which is slightly unusual, and the second part, which is that we have some real expertise in the power sector and also the battery sector on today. To give a little bit of flavour around who are Alpiq. Lucas, can I come to you?
Yes, Alpiq is a company that's been around since 2009, but actually the asset base that we have has assets which are over a century old. The core of the company is our hydropower portfolio, roughly 4.5 gigawatts. If you take the equity share of the power plants that we own, a very flexible portfolio which consists of pump storage, storage reservoir, as well as run of river. We also have two large stake of large nuclear power plants in Switzerland, one of them that we also have the mandate to operate. And outside Switzerland, we have a portfolio of a combination of flexible, increasingly flexible gas-fired thermal renewables. And we are also active commercially from B2B supply to more structured origination.
Okay. And so just to help listeners get an idea of the balance between how much is Swiss-based and how much is outside of Switzerland, is that sort of a 50-50 mix?
Yeah, roughly 60 to 65% of activities are in Switzerland.
Okay.
If you look at the power generation, on the commercial side, I would say 80% is outside Switzerland and 20% inside Switzerland.
Okay. And this is the first company I think we've had on who are Swiss-based. And so I think that gives you the right to be able to describe how the Swiss power market works. So would you like to have a go at just explaining the basics of how the Swiss power market works?
I think the Swiss power market is quite unique in its fuel mix. Roughly 60% is hydropower. About a third is nuclear. And the remainder is, I would say, more than renewables, wind and solar. But wind, I think we can count the number of wind turbines that we have in Switzerland on a few hands. Large-scale solar is non-existent, but rooftop solar start to actually kick a reasonable dent in the midday demand, and is like everywhere else in Europe, growing quite a lot. Switzerland has an interesting relationship with the EU. So it has been taking part of bits of the EU, but is not part of the EU. It's part of the European energy market, but hasn't fully adopted the EU energy directives. Mm-hmm. But broadly, the energy markets work very similar as we see in other markets. One big challenge that we have is that the forward market is not very liquid. So for that, we very much rely on the markets in neighboring geographies. And if you look at the neighbors of Switzerland, particularly Italy, France, and Germany, we see that we have a very different fuel mix than these markets. And the flexible hydropower that we provide is a very valuable complement to the nuclear in France, to the intermittent energy coming from the north. And in that way, it provides a natural balancing function between many of these markets and allows us to monetize the value of flexibility of our hydropower assets.
Super interesting. And I think I read somewhere that Switzerland has 10% of the hydropower that exists within Europe, which for a small country is quite a mighty chunk of the hydropower estate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's also among the most flexible.
Mm. Okay. Last question on Switzerland, just on the interconnection, because you mentioned how connected Switzerland is to those markets. What does that interconnection look like? Is it highly interconnected, or is that sometimes a kind of critical part of the constraint?
It is highly interconnected, and actually our neighboring markets rely on our flexibility, and we also rely on our neighboring markets. We see that particularly in the winter, Switzerland would struggle to survive without its neighbors, mm-hmm. and there's a high dependence, and I wouldn't be able to quote exactly the amount of gigawatt interconnection that we have, but it's highly interconnected.
Okay. And Lucas, then coming to you with the first question. So as a hydro major,
yep.
How do you think about the opportunity and challenge within storage?
Well, about 2 years ago, we started a discussion about the future strategy of Alpiq, and we realized that the increasing amounts of wind and solar, which is of course the big success of the energy transition so far, is also causing a number of challenges. And we looked at what we are naturally strong at and how we can play a role in the energy transition in line also with our purpose, mm-hmm. which we want to contribute to the energy transition and contribute to the security of supply. And what we realized is that not only hydropower is a natural complement, but if you look at the underlying capability that we have as an organization, being able to take the flexibility of hydropower towards the energy system can also be expanded towards batteries. And of course, a battery is technology very, very different than hydropower, but the role it can play in the energy system is very similar. And on the commercial side, we see a lot of synergies that we can take advantage of our market analysis and our trading capability to monetize the value of flexibility.
Okay. Nadia, you're really in the thick of this in terms of those battery assets. So how do you see those pumped hydro and battery assets comparing?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting what Lucas mentioned, that actually they are not competing technologies. They are complementing technologies, and they have quite different characteristics. If we speak about BESS, I think it's excellent for the short-term energy storage and for handling the intraday peak and wind solar. Of course, you can also put BESS relatively simply in many locations. The technology is also quite solid by now, and the cost in terms of cost is also quite competitive. If we speak about pumped hydro, then it's quite a different technology. It's very solid, very established. The lifetime for the plant's operation would be between 80 to 100 years. Of course, the construction time is much longer and investment is much bigger. But then if we speak about the operating regime, pumped hydro is perfectly positioned for the large-scale shifting of a lot of energy over the substantial period of time. For example, for the multi-day shifting of energy when we have a lot of clouds and no wind. And there is actually not much alternative to pumped hydros specifically for these situations. So we actually would like to have more pumped hydro, and we are looking for more opportunities in Europe. The problem is that pumped hydro is geographically constrained. You cannot put it anywhere, and actually the best locations are already very often used. And when we speak about the future, when we talk that we need maybe about 200 gigawatt additional flexibility assets in Europe until 2030, then it's evident that it cannot come from pumped hydro, and here most probably BESS would play a substantial role.
Yeah, I think we have numbers for GB of kind of talking like 40 to 50 gigawatts of battery build out for a market that is a demand of currently around 40 gigawatts ish. So I think that number around 200 gigawatts, where most of that might be coming from battery storage, is definitely sounds in a similar ballpark. And in terms of where Alpiq sees that flexibility coming from, are you looking much more at storage projects in terms of battery storage projects, or is there sort of a balance between battery storage and pumped hydro projects?
No, I think it's quite balanced. So we have both targets to have both pumped hydro and BESS. The difference maybe is more that for BESS, we can look at smaller projects, also, you know, distribute the risks much better between different countries. While for hydro, normally, as I mentioned, I mean, they are quite expensive, they are big, so you would not have too many targets distributed between different countries.
Okay. And would you, obviously, you're involved in many pumped hydro projects today. So would you consider retrofitting BESS onto some pumped hydro sites?
I think in general, using existing grid connections makes a lot of sense. We're actually building a combination of BESS and gas engines next to one of our thermal assets in Hungary, because we then see that we can provide AFFR that we cannot provide with our current CCGT. So I think the combination of these technologies would make sense. I think the combination of hydropower and BESS is not particularly more logic than any other combination. I think there are more logical combinations to combine, but I think the reuse of existing infrastructure is very helpful. Maybe just a side comment about, you mentioned we are involved in a lot of hydropower projects. We would love to. We own and operate many, but actually the last pump storage project that we opened took 12 years to construct. We opened it in 2022, 900 megawatt, 22 hours, more than 2 billion investments. So regretfully, we not have many of those opportunities around, but of course that experience allows us to get a seat on the table in many projects that we are discussing, and hopefully one of those will materialize and we would start a similar project like that somewhere across Europe.
And you mentioned that started life in 2022.
It did, yeah.
Is that correct? Okay. And just to understand the timeframes around that, so we last built pumped hydro in GB in 1980, so a long time ago now, and we are now planning to build pumped hydro. So it's kind of back on the roadmap. And for all things that you haven't done for 40 years, I imagine you might be a bit rusty. And so I think we will borrow expertise from other places and make sure that we can deliver it. But just for that project in 2022, what were the rough timescales on getting it to market and getting it built?
So the construction time took 14 years.
Okay.
That is a lot of time. I think you could do that shorter, but yeah. I think less than 5 to 7 years is not realistic. It bit depends, of course, what your starting point is. If you have existing reservoirs, or even an existing reservoir hydropower, and you can install the pump or replace the generator with a pump that can generate, then it can be done significantly quicker. Mm-hmm. But typically, it involves quite a lot of civil work. But actually, the more challenging part is getting it to a ready-to-build status. Because these projects, of course, depending on your preferences, they look amazing, and but not everybody has that view.
Yes.
We see a lot of resistance against our ambition to build additional storage capacity in Switzerland, and we're working very closely with local communities to. Show the benefits. And the benefits are not only in more stored energy, but also in controlling floods. Because one of the challenges that we see with climate change, and we saw it in Switzerland last year, is severe flooding. Yeah. And dams can actually be very helpful in actually managing these risks. But obviously, you can imagine the resistance people have against wind farms or solar projects, similar kind of dynamics we'll see around hydropower.
And this is a lot of the sort of snow and ice in the Alps is melting as you go into summer. That's really what you're talking about in terms of the like flood water.
It's that, and you see that with the more extreme weather, you see that melting water increases, the intensity of the rain in a short period of time also increases. And like we have seen that in many places, that has an impact also on flood risk.
And I think that 14-year number is also quite interesting. If your project is an 80 or 100-year asset, then 14 years doesn't feel very long to actually get that constructed. I think we have in GB, we also have some assets that have now run for 100 years. And obviously each component has been amended and swapped out, but we have had some pumped hydro sites that have run for 100 years, which is kind of a crazy statistic.
The technology has been extremely proven and extremely solid, and you build really something for generations. I mean, the pumped hydro I just referred to is literally built in the mountain. So if you go there, you drive for 6 kilometers into the mountain, and it is 600 meter below ground where the turbines and the pumps are placed in a space which has the size that almost fit in the Notre Dame inside. So it's amazing engineering, but you can imagine just the civil works to do the tunneling and create the do all the civil works linked to that.
You literally are moving mountains to make this happen.
Well, you know, the mountain's not moved, but we take things out of the mountain. We create because from the outside you don't see anything. That's the elegance of it.
Well, can you see something? So if you go to that site, can you? Is there ability to see anything around?
What you see the outside is, it's like a tunnel with a gate.
Okay.
But of course, if you then take an aerial view, you see an upper lake and a lower lake, which obviously are more visible. But the actual power plant is actually completely hidden in the mountain.
Okay. We could talk about pumped hydro for a long time, but let's go outside of pumped hydro and Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
Lucas, how do you think about those other markets outside of Switzerland? What's attractive in other markets where you're looking to apply some of your knowledge around pumped hydro flexible assets?
Well, I think what we see that the energy transition has been in some elements extremely successful. At the same time, it also causes a number of challenges. And I think in most markets where we operate, we see that solar has been so successful that it starts to create challenges in the shoulder hours. So what is very clear for us, if you look at the system perspective, that more flexible storage generation is needed to be able to integrate more renewables. And whether you look at Finland, where I was earlier this week, or whether you look at Italy or Spain or France, these challenges are increasingly visible. And you can see them, of course, on a daily basis in how that's reflected in the power prices, where you see zero prices or in some markets, strongly negative prices when the sun shines, and very steep prices when the demand is significant in the morning and the evening. And that, of course, provides the ideal opportunity for storage. In addition, we see that also the grid services market, so the products that the grid operator procures to make sure that the grid is stable, are increasingly needed. And pump storage and batteries are ideally suited to provide these services as well. Which markets are more attractive than others? I mean, the crystal ball of market price forecasting is a hobby. Oh no, it's a discussion point of everybody in the energy sector all the time. And I think the only thing that we know for sure is that we're all wrong. We don't know whether we are too low, whether we're too high. But we've been with almost 25 years in the energy sector. We have seen so many things we didn't see coming that we should not kid ourselves that we will get it right this time. But what is very clear is that with the extension of particularly solar in most European countries, but also wind in northern Sweden and in Finland, there is a significant additional need for flexibility, and markets are remunerating providing flexibility. I think the biggest challenge that we see, not whether there's a need for it, but whether the market would eventually saturate. And we've seen, of course, something happening like that in the UK, where suddenly the grid services prices dropped very significantly. But so we see, we look at the markets, we look which markets are there today, how are these markets going to evolve. In our view, the early years, we see a lot of revenue coming from grid services, but over time, it will be the intraday arbitrage where you would see most of the money. And if I see how much solar gets built, I think that there's still a need for a lot of short-term storage capacity.
So it's a really good kind of leading indicator for you is around solar capture rates. You know, for some regions in Europe, we're seeing capture rates for solar around about 50%. So it's fallen really quickly. That for you is a really good indicator for this market needs storage, as well as negative prices you mentioned as well.
Yeah, it's not only the percentage, it's also actually the height of the evening peak.
Yes.
If you look, for example, in Spain, where you have extreme low capture rates, I think we're approaching negative numbers almost. But because the relatively high installed capacity of gas to power, you don't see as high prices in the evening peak as we see, for example, in other markets. So in the end, even though I would definitely see the system need in Spain for battery energy storage, the economics for now don't look that attractive.
Those gas units have got to be getting hammered in terms of run hours. You know, you build that gas unit, you take a decision, you say, oh, I'm hoping to run for sort of 30%, 40% of the year. And yet a huge amount of solar is coming in, essentially providing all of the generation needed in the sort of summer periods or sunny periods. Those gas units are having to kind of recoup their money from a very, very small percentage of the year. So how is that not driving prices higher in those peaks?
Well, if you have enough power plants there, that's competition. But actually, we know that market a bit because we own and operate a CGT in Catalonia. And the plant was built to run baseload. And maybe to be turned off on the weekends. Last year, we started the plant more than 300 times. Now, weeks where we start more than 10 times are almost become the standard. And if I talk to the plant operators in the plant, they feel that we're driving the truck like a race car, which was not built for. But if I talk to our traders, they see, of course, the value of that flexibility. And we put a lot of effort and we continue to invest in making these assets more flexible, to minimize the run rates, to make them ramp up faster. And what you see is that in Spain, there have been a lot of challenging years, but we are very confident that now capacity payments will come into place. The EU has approved the Spanish proposal for that, and we're expecting that to come online. And then, of course, the economics are partly supported by the capacity payments that you get.
I think a fascinating market, and we definitely see parallels in terms of like where our capacity market is clearing in GB and how that's supporting gas units, how they juggle this kind of ability to not be running very many hours, but still be making enough money to stay open. And maybe I'll add one more thing, which is essentially as those gas units get to end of life, they need a major retrofit. Well, actually, how do you, as a government or a system operator, how do you encourage those gas units to stay around for another 15 years? Because we might need them for those sort of winter periods. I think it's a real challenge. It's probably one of the most interesting parts, I think, of how you plan power systems for the next 10, 15 years.
But you end up with actually, most, in my view, a different type of gas-to-power technology. As I just earlier mentioned, we're building now a extension next to our Hungarian CCGT, which is a combination of gas engines and batteries. Very old technology and very new technology. And they have the advantage that they can ramp up really, really fast. And due to the battery, we don't have to run them when they are not needed. Because if you want to provide flexibility with conventional gas power plants, you have to run them to be able to modulate. And I think you would see more of these kind of peaker capacity and really focus on a system that can actually run for these hours when needed. But also, and that's of course why there is still a role for gas to power also for quite some time, when there are periods with no wind and no solar, as the Germans would like to say, Dunkelflaute, we need to be able to run something for multiple days.
And yes,
batteries and also our pump storage will struggle to bridge these gaps. So there is indeed a role, and then I think the question is how do we decarbonize the last bit? Will then be a large challenge, or do we maybe accept not 100%?
Okay, I think that's a really interesting topic. Let's say, Lucas, that gives us a really clear steer on the strategy and the thinking behind how Alpiq is considering European power. Mm-hmm. Nadia, in terms of then executing the desire to get more batteries into the fleet, is this something that you think about as in terms of organic growth, so developing some of these battery projects from early stage sites? Or is this something where you'd look and you'd say, actually, there's a gigawatt of battery assets in this region, or there's 200 megawatts of battery assets in this region, very happy to come and buy these assets that are already operational?
Yeah, that was the decision that we had to take in the beginning of the last year. And for Alpiq, it was clear that with all our historical experience with trading flexibility, we want to be the long-term owner, operator, and optimizer of BESS assets. We also want to have central capability to procure EPC for all our assets across Europe to achieve economies of scale and better terms. But developing best projects is not our core competence. We might still consider it in the, for example, in Switzerland, in our home market, because we have quite many assets where it might make sense. But if we look at Europe, it was more or less clear that we would like to acquire projects. And this gives us the opportunity to save a lot of time to bring the assets to the market, so between 2 to 3 years. And also we could actually handpick the projects that we prefer for different reasons. And this is what we did. So I think within the last 12 months, we closed 3 transactions. At the moment, we have about 255 megawatt in our BESS portfolio of projects. And normally we focus on ready-to-build projects. All these 3 transactions were for ready-to-build projects. And it was also interesting to learn, you know, the experience when we were bidding for different projects, how we are perceived as the buyer. And I think that there are basically several aspects how you are assessed by the counterparty. I think it's about your reputation that you bring and financial strengths. Then it's about the offer that you make and the conditions attached to that offer. And then it's also about the speed of transaction that you can execute. And I think, especially on the last point, we improved a lot in the last year. And as I can judge from the market, we actually score quite well on all of these 3 points and very often can be seen as the favored buyer for the projects. So we continue with our scouting work. Like every week, actually, we revise new opportunities. We are trying to identify the best projects based on our criteria. And I'm looking forward to even speeding up our transaction
and
speed.
Those 3 transactions that you did, are you able to say a little bit about the size of each individual one and the location?
Yes. Yes. So the first transaction that we closed was last June in Finland. It was 30 megawatt. So we really wanted kind of to start small and test the market and run the process. And it's actually going to be connected to the grid, I think, in July this year, and then fully commercial operation date in autumn. And then second transaction was in Finland. It's 100 megawatt project. And third one was again
The second one was in France,
100 megawatt, and the third one was again in Finland, 125 megawatt project.
Okay, and you'll start to see those assets go live this year.
So the Finnish one goes this year, the first transaction that we closed, and the other 2, they are much bigger projects, so it takes also a longer time to construct them and bring them to the commercial operation date. So it's rather in 2027, first half of the year.
Okay. And those aren't necessarily conventional battery markets. So I talk a lot to lots of battery people in the market. GB's mentioned a lot. Germany's mentioned a lot. Italy's mentioned a lot. France and Finland, I would say, you don't hear so much. So what's the rationale behind those markets?
Yeah. So actually, Germany is also one of our focus markets. So far, our experience was that it's relatively complicated market to acquire ready-to-build projects, and maybe a little bit more on that when we talk about lessons learned. And I mean, the choice of the focus markets very much depends not only on the market conditions themselves, but also your presence. We have very solid presence in the Nordics and also in France. So those markets, they we can have synergies and they combine different operations. So it fully made sense for us to step into Nordics, into France, and Germany also, take into account the big part of the merchant exposure that we can have there. Okay. And if you speak about Italy, it's an interesting market because, with this MACSE scheme, it became very attractive to people that want to have a guaranteed return and they would accept lower returns, like for financial investments potentially. But this is not particularly interesting for us because we are in the market. We want to have exposure. We have the trading capabilities. So we are checking Italian market, but outside of the MACSE scheme, maybe, after the first auction takes place, then you can also see how the market then looks for the other projects and maybe more for the northern regions of Italy where only capacity payments potentially will be present.
Okay. Lucas, once you bring these assets into the portfolio, mm-hmm. Is this something that Alpiq are in a position to essentially just fund through equity, or are you looking at these projects and thinking, oh, we need to do a project finance agreement around this, and so we need to go and get a tolling agreement to back it up to make sure we've got revenue certainty? How do you think about these projects?
We typically finance these projects on our balance sheet. Of course, project finance has its advantages, but it also comes at a cost. And based on my experience with developing RES in other jobs, a lot of lawyers and bankers involved provide valuable project financing, but also take a lot of time and put quite a lot of restrictions, particularly in the construction period. So we are in a lucky position that we can balance sheet finance this. Actually, that also then takes away the need for a tolling agreement. So we seek the merchant exposure. We would look into ways of hedging it, but not necessarily by a tolling agreement, but thinking about what other exposures can we get commercially in our portfolio to create a better balanced portfolio. And actually, we see ourselves not only as an investor and owner and operator of batteries, but we also see ourselves as a counterparty that can provide tolling agreements to other investors. And we would be very eager and be discussing both in Germany as in the Nordics with a number of developers the potential to take a tolling agreement for periods 3 to 5, 7 years typically, where we see benefit in extending our exposure to this to BESS also commercially.
Effectively getting that exposure to BESS without necessarily having to buy the asset itself,
yep.
Provided you can reach a sort of sensible tolling agreement with the other party.
Exactly, yep.
And how busy is that keeping you on the tolling side?
Well, that keeps you quite busy because I remember a year ago at a storage conference, we were talking about BESS PPAs, and I said, these things didn't even have a name. So I think the people had to invent these contracts and got used to it. I think then at that point, there was still a challenge that the sellers of the tolling agreements, had price expectations were unrealistic because they were looking back 2 years into the energy crisis and they expected revenue levels which were not feasible. So you needed to there need to come some realism into that market as well. And then it is not a straightforward product because you would have to really think through not only what you agree commercially, but also how you do the actual operations of these assets, because you trade these assets very, very, very actively until very close to delivery. So the market operations is actually quite quite complex and need to be thought through. And that's why we also initially say, well, let's focus on the market where, from an asset perspective, we decided to focus on, which is the Nordics, France, and Germany, and seek to expand that to Italy and Switzerland with time as well. And why? Well, because that's where the market where we think the revenue in the next 3 to 5 years is most attractive.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I suppose within that tolling agreement, you've both got the kind of merchant element, which is that really near-term optimization. We're starting to see some markets, and this is almost linked to the PPA side, mm-hmm. In that effectively your traditional PPA was maybe more around you could get a sort of clean power PPA effectively by taking guarantees of origin and using those to essentially say this is clean energy. But in reality, some of those REGOs were coming from say solar in the middle of summer and were being used to apply to a winter period where effectively it was running off gas. Now, for someone coming with a Swiss mindset, this would all be quite odd because essentially when you've got nuclear and loads of pumped hydro, everything's quite clean. And so 24/7 clean PPAs is quite easy to do or are quite easy to do. But BESS in other regions, I think they have a potential where effectively they could help to provide clean power in winter periods. So moving, say, wind generation from when it is windy to when it's not windy, and therefore help people to do a more genuine sort of 24/7 green PPA. Do you think about that at all?
We do, particularly, of course, with the obligations that there are around green hydrogen. Mm-hmm. We have one hydrogen investment in Finland where we need to guarantee that we are providing the energy from green sources. We're talking to a number of other hydrogen developers, although the number is getting smaller and smaller, to find solutions. You see also data centers being very eager to be able to make that claim. At the same time, I think gradually the realism also starts thinking in that it's it's easy to go to 60, 70, 80%, but those last 20% are really increasingly more complicated. And so I think battery can play a role there. But the question is, do you want to make sure that one contract gets completely clean or that you get the system all over cleaner? And I think what my personal view is, and that's also the reason, and Alpiq's view is, that's also the reason why we continue to keep an open mind about a flexible thermal generation from with gas, is that we need to look at the system, the overall system carbon footprint. Yeah. And then there is a role to play. But I think batteries definitely can play a role, to answer your question, in giving more certainty about the green origin of the energy that customers are using.
Okay, fascinating. And Nadia, I've got one more question for you before I come back to you with final questions, which is around the projects that you have been acquiring so far. What would you say the lessons learned are on those projects?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because there are in Europe many geographies, different regulations, different markets. But if I summarize a couple of higher level lessons, then the first one is that we see a very wide range of IRRs that investors expect from BESS projects. So really, it can be between 8 to 18%. So there is the huge gap. And apparently, most of the like OPEX, CAPEX are relatively transparent costs. So the majority of this difference comes from the revenue projections. And it's clear that here we are speaking about, you know, still quite new asset class. We're speaking about 15 to 30 years of projections. So it's understandable that there is a huge uncertainty, which actually we cannot control today. We will see how it goes. So I think when we evaluate the projects, we try to focus on the things we can control at the moment. And for example, it can be about the choosing the right location with no limitations from the grid operator, or, you know, looking at the projects where they also like the local taxes are smaller or the time to the grid connection is faster. So some of these elements might not look so important in the beginning, but if we think about all that long-term operation and much bigger competition in the market in the future, actually, these details can make a difference between like profitable project and less profitable projects over the whole lifetime. And then second lesson, I think the common wisdom would be that, you know, if you came into this market, into the BESS market earlier, and for example, you already have, like the developer already has the project that is under construction, then they would think they should command a premium when they are selling that project. And it would be correct if the CAPEX costs were staying the same. But actually, CAPEX cost for BESS are falling quite substantially. We can see, I don't know, 10 to 15% decrease in the last 12 months. And this makes the valuation of the projects much more complex. You try to find, you know, the sweet spot where you capture the good CAPEX costs, but at the same time, you are still early enough in the market to also cover those front most profitable years of operation. And then the third lesson learned is that, you know, the market is still young and we see a lot of noise in the market. I mean, especially if we speak, for example, about Germany. Germany is a very prominent market. Everybody's telling that, you know, it's huge, it's very prospective, and this is true. But if we look at the details, I mean, there is very fragmented regulation, which now I think the German government is trying to kind of to improve a little bit. There are very many announcements of, you know, this large scale blockbuster projects, 500 megawatt, 1000 megawatt. I mean, the grid is oversubscribed more than 10 times compared to what can be connected. So like there is a lot of news, but if you really go and check the actual transactions, you would see that there are not too many at the moment, especially for these large projects. And maybe part of the explanation goes back to, you know, those revenue projections that it's actually, I think the market is still young and those mechanisms to transfer risk between different parties is still not established. So with the tolling agreements or other agreements so that more investors can actually feel comfortable to stepping into that market. And, you know, that ecosystem still has to be built, which probably will take some time so that we go to the actual transactions in the range of, you know, 10 to 20 to 40 gigawatt of needed new BESS capacity in Germany by 2030.
Oh, we've got a long way to go to get to 200 gigawatts. Yes. Okay. This is a super useful explanation of how you're seeing those markets. And I think for many people listening who are kind of thinking about some of those regions, I think they will find those rules around transacting best projects very helpful. I'd like to come on to one final question, but to both of you, which amounts to two questions. And Nadia, maybe I'll come to you first, asking for your contrarian view. So is there something that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
Yeah, perhaps it's not exactly contrarian, but something that I deeply believe in. You know, I'm mostly working in the transactional environment, and you would imagine that, you know, this is really about the tough negotiations, about the performance-driven environment, and quite a lot of stress, which, yes, it is present. It is part of this work. But on the other hand, I always try to keep big picture that, you know, even if we are sitting at the opposite sides of the table, we are eventually still together in the same boat of energy transition. So if you're a developer or the financial institution or the long-term investor, actually, we are working together, you know, to bring these targets and to ensure the security of supply for the future. And I think actually this is what is making working in this industry presently so exciting. Mm.
We have far more in common than we think.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, Lucas.
Good. I joined the energy sector in the liberalization phase. And I think many people are in the energy sector see that as a given and the right direction. And when I spent 5 years in Brazil, I realized that the regulation that you have is not a law of nature. That is just a combination of rules set up to challenge, to address the problem at the time. When I went to Brazil, the regulation was set up to address a shortage of power after a particularly dry period at the beginning of the century. And the rules are completely different than they are in Europe. And I think the challenge that we have in Europe is we have the wrong set of rules for the challenge of today. The rules were made to make the energy system more cost efficient. And we split the market roles between the system operator and the grid owner and the generation and the supplier. And at the moment, we see that all these actors, they play their part, they play largely by the rules, but they should think about collaborating a lot more, and the rules actually prohibit them to collaborate more. And I think, to put it metaphorically, I think the orchestra of the energy transition misses a conductor to make sure that everybody plays towards the same tune of the energy transition. And maybe the clear example that we see now with solar, of course, the success child of the energy transition, it kept surprising everybody how cheap it got. And now it keeps surprising how much we have of it, and we actually start having too much. Yeah? And I think unless we start to see a better orchestration of the orchestra, yeah, we will run into more and more challenges, and we will be inefficient in solving them. And I believe in entrepreneurialism and finding solutions through the market, but I think in building a resilient and sustainable energy system, we need a higher degree of orchestration.
Okay, superb. Well, both, thank you very much for your time on Transmission. You've been fantastic guests. We have brought light to many complex areas, from Swiss power markets to battery storage in Finland to the need for orchestration. It's been a fantastic episode. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for having us.